Thanks to Windows 10, the applications you build could run on any device in any size. How do you adapt your user experience so that it's excellent? Well, we have the tools for you, and that's what we're talking about today on Dev Radio. Welcome to the next episode of Microsoft Dev Radio. I'm Jerry Nixon, and I'm here with Harini and Ben, a PM and a dev lead on the XAML team that worked with all the adaptive stuff that we're going to talk about today. But before we start talking about all the technology, let's talk about the people. Harini, tell us, who are you?
Hey, Jerry. I'm a PM from the XAML team. I've been working with the XAML stuff for over 4 years now. That's the time I've been at Microsoft. Through Windows 10, I've been working with Ben as co-lead for some of the adaptability stuff that we've built in the platform for our developers.
Cool. And Ben, tell us who you are.
Hey, Jerry. So I'm a dev lead on the XAML team, and I've been in Microsoft for almost 8 years now. And Believe it or not, I've been working with XAML technologies the entire time that I've been here. When I started, we were kind of just putting the finishing touches on Silverlight 2, and I've been working with the same team and the same code base ever since then.
Wow, that is incredible. And a lot of people don't know, but the XAML team has kind of flowed through the company from every variation of XAML. It's still the same. Many of them are still the same guys from the very beginning.
Yeah, that's right. And some of the folks go back to WPF, and some of the folks even go back, you know, well beyond that to some work that happened in the browser side, which was provided some of the original ideas for some of the concepts that we have in XAML.
Yeah, I think that's one of the beautiful things about XAML, that developers, they feel it, but they don't know it, right? They're like, wow, it just seems, as we go across everything, there really is not just a similarity, but it's the same thing. I mean, it just feels right. You're using similar, if not identical, namespaces. And part of the reason is Microsoft's a great place to work. And we're, you know, these guys are still with us. And they love XAML. There are people who love XAML and they code in it. And then there are people who take XAML and just kind of rub it in their hair. They love it so much. So, you know what I mean? I mean, you met them, right? They love it. And if they feel like it's in jeopardy at all, they're mad, man. They are in a community to reckon with. There's no doubt about it. They're almost like JavaScript developers in their insanity. Is what I meant, of course. Yeah, but I love them. Hey, I'm one of those guys too. I love XAML all the way around. And so what we're going to talk about here is I'm building an application, and I need some sort of mechanism as I'm going from one screen size to another, or maybe I'm using Continuum. And I'm going to be on my phone, and then suddenly I'm going to be on a television. Or I'm going to be, I've written the app, and I want it to run on a phone, so now it's going to be small again, or they're dragging from window to window, or resizing. That sort of stuff is not new to us, because as web developers, there are techniques that we've kind of come across. But as a XAML developer or a native developer, you know, we have a different experience, and the toolkit, you know, was missing some things, and we've filled those gaps. You guys have really filled them. And as you're thinking, how are we going to make adaptive UI easier, better for developers? What are you guys thinking through? What's your process?
Well, one of the things that we looked at early on was, we know that, you know, this is a problem that's been solved in many different ways on many different platforms. And we did want to be pretty comprehensive and kind of look across the broad spectrum of what's out there and see what's worked well and what's worked poorly as other platforms have attempted to tackle this problem. So We looked real hard at the web, we looked real hard at Android, we looked real hard at iOS, and we just kind of took a pulse, and we tried to see which techniques developers have tried in Lite and which techniques have led to problems.
And throughout that whole thinking, we've also tried to keep the entire developer model as simple and intuitive as possible without overloading our developers with too many concepts and too many things to think about. Because, you know, with Windows 10, that's the whole idea. We want to keep it simple. You write one app and it just works everywhere that your OS runs on. And, you know, as a developer, you want to care about the most simple things and make sure that your UI just works beautifully everywhere if it's possible. As you know, but there might be some requirements for you where you are looking for some kind of branding or tailoring where you do want a very distinctly different experience. And we have some tools for that as well. But we didn't want to start there. We wanted our developers to start in a place where it's just easy to write an app and just have it work.
So simple yet extensible is kind of the idea.
Yep.
Yeah. And I imagine, and because I know where we're headed with this talk, I know that it's also what do we already have, right? Rather than building something brand new, things like we're going to talk about visual states and things like that, things that were already native to XAML, that can we make those part of the solution, right? I'm sure a lot of that was there rather than introducing net new stuff.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly right. You know, you mentioned this at the very beginning. XAML has always had some level of adaptability as part of its basic core concept. Unlike certain other frameworks that kind of started off with the idea of fixed window sizes, the various incarnations of XAML have pretty much always had the notion of some level of adaptability within the platform. And so we definitely didn't want to, it's exactly what you said. We wanted to build on what we already had and make it even better and even easier to use for some of the newer Windows 10 universal app type scenarios.
Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah, even all the way back to WPF, we had things like Doc Panel or with Star, you know, all these things you would do as things would get moved around, your app was still usable. And occasionally, and this is an amazing thing to even say, but occasionally a developer would dabble with visual states, right? And it's funny because visual states and the power that they have in the XAML world, right, is their ability to just redefine everything. And without even thinking about it, just call a single string, and all of a sudden, your entire UI shifts around, animates if you want, all of these things that really you hardly have to do anything to make happen. But a lot of developers seem timid around visual states, at least in the early days. Now, as we go forward, obviously, we've adapted the Visual State Manager so that that's a big part of our adaptive story. But what is it about visual states? What do you think has caused a lot of developers to be timid around it?
I'm not sure, Jerry. Maybe it's a little bit of it's a different API and a different type of developer model than, say, CSS. The way you probably style your app with CSS is a slightly different model than what you would do with visual states. And visual states have generally been a little bit of a thing that is more of a tooling kind of a thing that you use from Blend or Visual Studio to automatically create that kind of markup, generate that markup more from a machine language standpoint than for handwriting code. So that's kind of where it originally started, and that's why you, before Windows 10, the type of code that you had to write inside a Visual State Manager was pretty verbose, pretty unintuitive. It was just impossible to envision how you would handwrite some of those animation codes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, maybe that's it. Maybe because it required Blend, and a lot of developers, I always think it's because of the dark theme, are like, oh, Blend isn't for me, it's for designers. And of course, we know that's not true now, especially with visual states, where how we're going to edit them is going to be so easy in Blend. And Blend is really the tool for developers doing design-related tasks, right? It's not for designers. There are other tools that have just proven to be fantastic for that. All right, so we'll start with, well, you tell me, what is our adaptive strategy?
So the adaptive strategy for Windows 10, like I was saying before, we have kept it really simple. We have kind of said that the simplest story is that as an app developer, you probably want to care about your app in terms of sizes, the size that the app's window can probably fit in terms of width and height. And as long as you create your UI in such a way that it scales up as the window sizes up or scales down as the window size is small, you're going to be having a pretty good enough experience across the breadth of devices that support Windows 10. So our adaptive strategies kind of center around window widths and window heights.
Okay. So first of all, developers should build, as they're building a UI, make it so it's flexible and not rigid. I mean, that's of course, the sort of thing we get from web development. But then we also have this idea of, I guess, do you call them snap points, like major areas where we kick in something? What do you call those? When the width gets to a certain size?
Yeah, that's a real interesting topic. I think we probably use the term breakpoint internally, but I've heard snap point used a lot as well. We've had long discussions about how much of our developer story do we want that to be. When you look at some other platforms, those are kind of front and center. A lot of the web frameworks for adaptability really kind of bake that in as a central concept. There is definitely some importance there. I mean, when you look out at the ecosystem and the kinds of devices that people use, clearly there are going to be certain sizes that are more important than other sizes. At the same time, we really believe in letting the content try to dictate adaptability as much as possible.
Okay.
our ecosystem is so broad and it encompasses so many different kinds of devices and usage patterns, and it's gonna broaden out even more into the future. And I think that's a huge advantage and value add of our ecosystem. And so we always encourage people to think about content first instead of thinking about kind of snap points and breakpoints as a starting point.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah, sure. And then when they start thinking, they have to think not only width, but they also have to think device as well as they move to a different device and they want to adapt it as well. I was amazed a couple of days ago we were talking to the MSN Apps team, and one of the things that they said is they use Visual States, and their entire UI is set up inside one big view, and they move it around so that as they go from desktop to phone and continue up to television, they really are reusing all the XAML in the same screen, and by using these techniques. So let's talk about just handling size for just a second. So Harini, you were talking about height and width is a big starting point, and obviously that's important. Tell me what are developers' options? What should they do? What should they think about? And what are we giving them to handle height and width?
So one of the new APIs that we've introduced in Visual State Manager is the API called Adaptive Triggers and State Triggers. So what you can do right now is in Visual State Manager, right in markup, all you have to do is add a single line of markup that says when the window height is at a minimum of so and so pixels, or the window height is so and so pixels, trigger this particular visual state. And within that state, you can have the properties that you want to change in your UI so that your UI gets repositioned or readjusted or sized differently, you know, that kind of thing.
So I'll put my adaptive trigger into my. So this is a big deal because prior to this, it was all in code behind, right? I would have to listen for the window size event change, and when that happened, I would have to determine what its size was and whether or not it matched what I wanted, and then call out to the Visual State Manager to switch to a different state. And so basically, we're taking all of that work and putting it into just an adaptive trigger that we say, what's the height, what's the width, we'll do all the rest for you.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, and it's an easy thing. Are those two properties, the height and width, are those two properties an OR condition or an AND condition?
You can use them in both ways. So the way you can do it is in markup, if you have both of them declared under the same adaptive trigger. For example, if you have a markup that says adaptive trigger min window width equals 720 and min window height equals 800 in the same line, then it becomes an AND condition. However, if you have the adaptive trigger split into two lines of code where you can say adaptive trigger min window width equals 720, and then in a second line that says adaptive trigger min window height equals 800, then it becomes an OR condition.
So in the new visualstate.triggers property, I can have more than one adaptive trigger, and if any of those fire, then that visual state will become active.
Yes.
I see. So that's how we'll do an OR. Oh, that's very cool. Very cool. All right. So that's important. I'm going to create my breakpoints, my visual breakpoints, so as I move to something that's too narrow for my content to be able to squeeze into, I'm going to switch it to a new view that I've created, new visual state that I've created, and it'll automatically switch based on using these adaptive triggers that I put that same value. And now that value is the width, and to be clear, that's not the pixel width, right?
So that's basically the effective pixel width.
Which is our calculation of a generic size, so that it makes it resolution independent across all the different devices.
Yeah, it's really the units that we want developers to be thinking in terms of. It allows us to abstract away things like physical pixels, things like pixel density, things like viewing distance, and kind of lets us give a consistent experience in terms of perceived sizes of things across that broad range of devices that we have.
So as a developer, all you have to do is think in terms of effective pixels, and we'll kind of abstract everything else for you.
So every time I say what the size, the width, the height, the length of something inside XAML, it's always effective pixels. I'm never actually saying number of physical pixels on my monitor. I'm never saying that.
That's right. Yeah, we kind of have a mantra that we use internally, which is anytime that physical pixels actually leaks through the developer surface in some way, that's actually a bug that we go fix, because we want that to purely be an internal implementation detail.
Very nice. So obviously I make all my controls a certain size, and I also make this adaptive trigger a certain size. I never have to worry, is this a 10K monitor, or is this a crummy little phone that has an old screen on it? None of that matters. It's going to look beautiful and handle, and you guys do all the heuristics and math behind the scenes, so yeah. I don't have to. Yeah, and that's honestly, that's kind of been a feature of XAML from the beginning. It's been one of those, they were called machine independent pixels, I think, at the beginning or something crazy like that. But yeah, this idea of we're going to abstract this away because it's crazy to have to think like that. All right, so we know that adaptive triggers do the same thing, of course. And so I get down to a certain size, it switches to another visual state for me. What if that's not enough? What if my logic, honestly, Harini, my logic's a little more sophisticated than that. I also need to know whether or not it's Monday, for example. What can I do? I want to show a certain UI on Monday, but you know what I mean? How can I – what are my options as a developer?
Sure. Your options pretty much include a lot of things. You can do a whole bunch of code handling for every piece of UI that you have, which is the story that you had before Windows 10. What we have done in Windows 10 is actually use the beautiful model that XAML has always been built off of, which is extensibility, and made our triggers extensible. So the built-in trigger that we have is the adaptive trigger, which goes off of based on window height and window width. But as a developer, you can pretty much extend the base class for adaptive trigger, which is the state trigger base, and create any kind of custom trigger. For your scenario, you would create a custom trigger for is it Monday trigger or something like that. And once you create that trigger and define it in a class, you can use a trigger in any markup that you have, and that trigger would automatically fire based on the logic that you want.
And I haven't looked, but I would assume the adaptive trigger that ships out of the box uses state trigger base, just like I would if I were writing my own trigger. It just happens to do all the listening for the window size for me.
Yep, that's right.
You guys are using the same stuff that I am, yeah. And to be clear, a developer might be listening and say, now what kind of triggers do I have again? And there's one. When you hear the word adaptive trigger, that's really the height-width trigger. Mm-hmm. And from that point forward, if that's not enough, which that should be enough for a lot of apps, right? I mean, if you really think about it. But when you start getting to a sophisticated requirement that requires Monday, or whether or not the user's logged in, or whether or not you're all these other things, then you just extend it by using the state trigger base, create your own custom trigger, and there's a lot of values in creating your own like this rather than putting in code behind.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. When we were designing this feature, as I mentioned, we were looking at a lot of other solutions that are out there. And one thing that we realized pretty quickly is that what a lot of other platforms do is they basically just throw a whole bunch of options at your face, like a huge set of options, and make you kind of sort through them. And if you look at the way that some of the other platforms do adaptability, you might see 14, 16, 20 properties, that you can kind of tweak. That's very hard to sort through as a developer. Many of those properties are incredibly specific to a certain problem domain and just not that interesting to a lot of developers. It's a high concept count.
And more often than not, even if we ship like 20 different properties in the platform, that would still probably not be enough. All of these are kind of solving edge cases and unique problems that people have. So we found that it's much better to have a model where we just make it extensible and do the leave it to the developers to figure out whatever they wanted and just do it themselves.
And I've written dozens of these custom triggers, and a developer might be thinking, here we go, I've got to write a custom trigger. A custom trigger is nothing. There's nothing, no implementation necessary other than just calling, is it active? I can't remember.
And it just is active.
Is active, yeah, and just triggers it. It's such an easy thing, and now you can even encapsulate it, reuse it on your next view, reuse it on the next page as well. You could have it up in a library if you find you use it across your enterprise on all your different ones and how to determine different things. And so really, it's a neat way, bugs that kind of trickle down from view to view because you don't have this ability. So in a lot of ways, it's awesome. And I think, Ben, when you were saying with all of these different options, I mean, you could have made the adaptive trigger. Now, I know you could have. You could have made the adaptive trigger handle zillions of scenarios.
Right.
And it would have millions of properties, and each property would have to have a negative as well, right? It would have to be not, has internet, not has internet, is logged in, isn't logged in. I mean, all the way down, right? And then greater than or less than some number, and it would become a control that developers wouldn't enjoy using anymore, right? And they would feel like it was too brittle or easy to get wrong.
Yep, precisely. And, yeah. and I want to reiterate a point that you made. That's such a great point. You know, we really spent a lot of time designing the interface of this extensibility point to be incredibly easy to use. I think most XAML developers are probably familiar with converters that you would use in data binding. We wanted that level of simplicity, just an incredibly easy to understand model. And I think what we came up with really does fit that bill.
Yeah. Yeah. All you have to do is inherit state trigger base and you're done in a way, right? And then just fill out your own logic, call out to a web server, whatever it is that you need for your application from that point forward is up to you. Then you just call isActive. So easy. All right, so we've the first enhancement we've done to make life easy is about 10 years ago, we gave everybody Visual State Manager. That's the first thing we did. The second thing we did is we've enhanced the Visual State Manager now so that all these triggers now can be not only encapsulated, but you don't have to have code laying around as well with the idea of Visual State Triggers. What else have we done?
So we talked about the verbosity of visual states in our earlier models before Windows 10. That was purely because it was coming from a tooling standpoint, and most people kind of never hand wrote visual states. But as these kind of adaptive scenarios started taking shape, it was very clear that we wanted to make sure that it should be a little more intuitive to handwrite code in there. So what we did was we introduced new APIs called setters, which is basically the same setter concept that we've always had in styles, but enhanced them to be supported inside Visual State. So now you can just have a very simple single line of markup in order for you to have a property and a value associated with it.
So now I could just, if I need to change something from collapsed to visible, I just use a setter to change it from collapsed to visible. Now I don't have to use a storyboard to animate it from collapsed visible, which is a crazy animation anyway because there's nothing in between, right? It's all this extra stuff around storyboards is all put away, and I could just say setter one line and I'm good to go.
Yep.
Yeah, it's such an easy little thing. And how many people hand code that? When you were saying that, I was like, I'm thinking of all, if anybody is ever grinding their teeth on visual states, it's because they're hand coding it, right? Because there's so much. Blend just, and it's done. But you're thinking that this may actually make it a little bit more accessible to do simple visual states because now there's such a simple way to set these properties.
Yep, it was kind of something internally as well. When we were our internal process involves a lot of speccing and all that stuff. So with setters, it was pretty easy. When we wrote the spec, it was okay. This is what it used to look like, and it was so verbose storyboards and animations. And the minute everybody saw what the simplified single line of syntax looked like, it was just, this is awesome, and just go for it.
Yeah, nice. VSM is really powerful. And, to be honest, a lot of that power was really designed at the beginning to be sort of targeted by our tools. We have some awesome tools that can let you design these incredibly complex animations and effects and interfaces. And, VSM was really designed at the beginning to kind of reflect that amount of power. To be honest, the original thinking going into it way back when was not necessarily that it would be written by a developer or even read by a developer in a lot of cases. Yeah. But then when you step back and kind of look at how it's often used in real-world apps, the actual use cases, all that power and complexity is certainly a common use case, but another really common use case is it just ends up looking a lot like CSS rules. People basically just want to have a bag of properties that they apply at a given point in time or at a given state or condition. And, all that power and all that flexibility makes it a little bit hard to express that relatively simple use case in a way that's easy to write and more importantly, easy to read
easy to reason
about. Yeah.
So, while we were introducing this, we wanted to make sure that all those other use cases that it was enabling are still enabled. So you can still use the storyboard. You can still use VSM the way you used it before. It's just that we've enhanced it to also support these other scenarios together.
That's right. This is still the VSM you've grown to love. Now it just has even more capabilities than it had before.
Yep.
That's right. And I think we're kind of moving into a season of XAML development where XAML developers need to just buckle down and become very familiar with the way VSM works because it's just going to make their life easier as they're moving into this adaptive world. Another way I might need to adapt is if I go from device to device, I can easily use a custom trigger to do that as well by listening for the family or something like that, right? There's no limitation to what I can do in the custom, in a custom trigger, right? There's no, is there a limitation, some sort of scope limit or anything like that?
Nope, nothing at all. Any WinRT API that exists can be used inside a custom trigger to create any kind of trigger that you want.
Makes sense to me. That makes sense to me. So here I am. I have my application. I've set up a handful of views at these breakpoints where I know that I need to move things around. And then in order to move them around, I've got most of my UI, like most developers, most of my UI is based on a grid. I set things out in one location, in this corner, along the top, wherever it is. And as I move them, I need to actually move some content over to this location. So I've actually hidden a row, and now I move it into a hidden row. And all of a sudden, it feels, I don't know what the right word is, kind of clunky, right? Golly, a grid is nice, but moving it around, I can't trust a free flow kind of layout. I need to control it. But a grid seems like it's just not the right solution. A lot of developers feel the same way. And so what have we given them? What's the next option?
That's a great question, Jerry. So one of the new things that we've introduced, that's other than VSM, is also a panel called Relative Panel. A lot of people who are used to Android development or iOS, are used to this kind of a layout where you can actually create layout based on spatial relationships between elements. So basically, you can say that, okay, I have element A over here, and I want it to be right off element B, or I want it to be like above or below. So, having that kind of a mental model and then being able to declaratively mention the same model is basically what Relative Panel gives you. Mm.
So now instead of saying it's in a cell 1, row 1, mm-hmm. then what's the alternative?
So instead of, I don't want to say instead of, because, grid has its powers. A grid control, when you have a tabular UI, a mental model that completely maps to that would be a grid. So we would want you to still use grid for those kind of scenarios. Relative panel is more for scenarios that are a little more complex, a little more composite. UI is just positioned in different places. It's not necessarily tabular, and it's not necessarily a single row of stack. So it's a little bit of a more, combinatorial approach. In those cases, you can position your element based on other elements as well as position them based on the panel itself. So you can say that, I want this particular element to be always at the bottom of my panel. And you can say align bottom with panel equals true, and that will just make it happen. Even if your window is resized, the element will be moved along with it.
So that it's always at the bottom of the panel no matter what happens.
Yep.
Nice. And then I can align with the panel. And then what about individual elements as I need to move them around?
Yep, you can position them with respect to individual elements. We call them siblings because all of them are kind of parented to the same panel. So between siblings, you can have like above, below, right off, left off, those kind of relationships. You can also have a little bit of an alignment relationship. You can say, I want the right edges of these two elements to be aligned together. So what you can do is you can position A, and then with B, you can say aligned right with and say B inside that. And that will automatically align the edges together.
So if I have a complex scenario where I have lots of elements and I'm moving around and making sure they look just right, I can make it so that, this element is right of this element. This element is below this element, and they all lay out the way I want in the relative panel. And when I need to move them, I only move kind of like the anchor, the first one that they're all based on, right?
Yep, you can totally do that. And, one of the advantages that Relative Panel brings for you is, there are basically two advantages. If you do have, adaptability requirements where you're moving chunks of UI here, around when the window resizes or stuff like that, if you were using grid, there were probably two mental models that people would usually use in those kind of scenarios. One would be to have multiple copies of the same elements and just toggle visibility on them. Based on what you wanted to show, because moving them is not always easy. So people did that a lot. Or you had like super grids where you would have like extra rows and extra columns and column spans and row spans, and you would just kind of toggle those kind of properties in order to make your elements move a little bit. Both of those concepts are a little bit, they're not performance efficient because you're having multiple copies of the same elements, and it's definitely not intuitive in terms of the developer model to have that kind of behavior. So Relative Panel kind of takes away both of those problems. Because you can now easily, just by changing the relationship property on an element, you can now move them relatively easily within the panel.
And I could take, so if I had, let's say I had two things, I could say this is left of this, and then I could say, I could just switch it, and I could say now it's right of this, and it just switches to the other side right there for me the way I want it to go, and I can use a setter inside VSM.
Yep,
And it's almost like these things work together. It's almost like somebody's thinking about this whole thing holistically. It's really nice. Now, if I'm a developer, let's say I do have two things, and they are, one says one's left of this, and I want to move it below, let's say. Mm-hmm. When I go to my visual state that says the below visual state, and I want to move it so that it's below, do I set below and unset right of, or like what do I need to do for those properties?
That's a great question. So with right of panel, the recommended developer model would be to, for things that you are going to change, for any relationship property that you're going to change, we would recommend you to put it inside the visual state explicitly, yep, instead of having your default markup have that particular relationship. So for example, if you know that element A's relationship with element B is going to change dynamically, we would say that in your default markup, do not put any relationship on element A, and instead define the two different relationships in two explicit visual states and just go between them.
I see, because if I define them in markup, then I need to undefine them when I go to the visual state.
The way
which
visual
undefine...
states...
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so the way visual states work is that when a visual state no longer applies, when a trigger no longer is true, we automatically go back to your default markup. And whatever is the properties that you're defining inside your visual state are kind of overwritten on top of what you have in your markup. So if you did define a relationship in your markup and you forgot to unset it, you might result in like conflicting relationships in your visual state.
Yep, that totally makes sense. Yeah, where you could have your UI doing some funky stuff. And when the layout, if I start laying things out and I start putting, if let's say this is aligned to, is this your left? It's my left. Is this your left? And then this is also aligned to its right. If I move it over to this side, does it move out to make room for it? How does it handle clipping?
So I guess I would describe it as the clipping works generally intuitively. The panel will clip things where you set up relationships that push outside of it. There are some interesting edge cases where we will do different things to sort of compute the proper desired size for the panel, depending on how you're using it. A lot of this, if you stick the relative panel itself in something that's going to give it kind of a flexible size, the behavior will be slightly different than if you constrain the size of the relative panel, just like set a height and a width on it or something like that.
I see.
Yeah, and so you also have to be aware of the constraints that you are setting on your elements. For example, by default, every element is positioned at 0, 0 on the relative panel. So if you have an unconstrained element, say the first element you put on the relative panel is element A and it has no relationships, basically it will be at 0, 0. And then you have the second element B, and then you say element B is above A, then element B is going to be clipped out of the panel because you're basically saying that you want it outside the bounds of the panel at that point.
Ah, makes sense to me. And is, so now I have a question back to how we set and unset and declare and don't declare. I'm inside my designer. Specifically, I'm inside Visual Studio, inside the XAML designer, and I love the fact that there is design support. At least it will parse it right and show it the way it needs to be, or the way it's really going to be. And I can't wait for. And I think it's worth at least mentioning to developers that are watching. There's no design time experience of repositioning yet, and but I mean I know the team and I know that's coming. But the question I have for you is, if my default is not to declaratively relate them, what's my design time experience? It seems like, aren't they all going to be at 0, 0 stacked on top of one another?
Yep. In the design time experience, they would be stacked on top of one another.
We need like a D colon with it or something like that, so you can do it in the designer and then let the visual states handle it someday. All right, well, that's just me talking something. But a developer who does what we just said, their design time experience will be all of their items at 0, 0.
Yep, unless you position them, it's going to be 0, 0. So the idea is that I think the Visual Studio team is also building some tooling around this where you can actually, when you're in your visual states and you're putting those constraints, you will be able to see what your UI looks like in the designer even you're in that visual state. So you'll be able to see if you are actually using a particular visual state.
Yeah. Stack panel, grid, relative panel, they all have their place. I mean, nobody needs to listen to this and hear us saying relative panel is replacing some control, right? This is just another tool for a specific scenario.
Yep, that's exactly right. We're not sort of deprecating anything that we have today. Mm-hmm. I would really encourage all XAML developers to go and kick the tires on Relative Panel. It doesn't take long to learn at all. Even if you're completely unfamiliar with constraint-based layouts, it's a pretty intuitive model to pick up. Most other platforms that have this kind of constraint-based layout, it ends up being a very popular layout on those platforms. The work that I did before coming to Microsoft was on a platform that had a layout a lot like this, and it was probably the most commonly used layout on that platform.
Got it. Well, I mean, I've used it. It's a simple thing to use, and honestly, a lot of difficult scenarios are solved quickly. It's really, really nice. You got to think it through. It's a little bit different. It's not the same as a grid, so it doesn't behave exactly like a grid, so there's things you need to know. But beyond that, it's really terrific. And so I can still see plenty of scenarios where I'd use a grid instead, plenty of scenarios. And honestly, I can see most scenarios where I'd use a mixture of them, where I'd have a little bit of this and a little bit of that to make it all work. And what's nice about a relative panel, and you tell me if this was part of your design goal or just one of these serendipitous benefits. When I look at a design or I look at my XAML of a relative panel versus, say, the same layout with a grid, it is so tiny. I don't even have to scroll. It's all just right there. All my XAML so simplified. I can only imagine that the parsing and rendering performance cost is much lower. Is it?
Well, I agree, and I really love sort of some of the readability aspects that you get with Relative Panel, and I've experienced that as well. You know, layout is something that we spend a lot of time perf tuning on. It is such a core central part of the XAML framework, and it's a place where any performance work that we do tends to just provide a lot of benefits across our ecosystem. We actually have had people looking at all of our panels and doing as much performance tuning as we can reasonably fit into a release. So I think we're at the point today where, you know, barring a few differences here and there in some specific scenarios, all the panels are roughly in the same ballpark in terms of performance.
Okay. Well, that's good to hear.
And, you know, I guess the thing I would say is each panel probably has certain anti-patterns or certain things that you can do that will, like, you know, kill performance. You've already mentioned some of them, but, you know, we try to be pretty clear in our guidance about, you know, just don't do those things, and here's what you can do instead.
Okay. Well, give me some ideas of as people are using visual states and as people are using these tools, have you seen anything that developers should avoid?
One thing to keep in mind with Relative Panel, this is just really true of constraint-based layouts in general, is that especially when you're first learning how to use them and what some of the best practices are, it can be easy to kind of over-constrain and over-specify things. The path to success with these panels is really to specify only what you need to specify. A lot of the default behavior of elements and of the panel itself provides you kind of a skeleton that you can then build specific behaviors on top of. The nice thing about not over-specifying is that when you need to make changes, either as you maintain a piece of UI going forward, or if you're talking about adaptive changes that you might make at runtime, the fewer constraints that you have to reason about, the easier it's going to be to sort of understand those changes.
Yeah, because fewer moving parts, fewer things to think about. Yeah, that makes plenty of sense. I could see where you would be like, you would want to make it right of this, but you know, it's going to be left of that, so I might as well say that too, even though you don't really need to say that because it's already handled in other places.
Yep.
Yeah. So we're talking about adaptability. We're talking about how our apps will work as we move from screen to screen or maybe device to device. So we have this ability to use visual states, which we know are terrific and that they've been enhanced now to be even easier and more readable and all of these things. What about the idea of XAML views? What about the idea of what if I just had two views, like two physical files? Is that an option the developers should consider?
So the option has always been there and it continues to be there. You can absolutely create a different, completely different XAML view or a XAML file and, switch between them. I think one of the things that have been introduced is a little bit of a easier tooling side where they have kind of rationalized in a way that you can have multiple XAML files against a shared code behind. And I think that's been a feature that's been introduced as well. What we have observed as patterns that people use is that almost all of the simple adaptability of your UI is kind of achieved with VSM. And whenever there is very drastic differences between your, you know, UI, between either tailored experiences that you want for Xbox or something like that, yeah, and it's completely different from what you have for desktop, then yeah, absolutely, you should be able to totally create a completely different XAML file and just, based on your logic and code, just load the right one.
And this is really a let the buyer beware moment, too, where, yeah, you can do it, but suddenly there's a lot you need to think about, and making sure that your element names don't change and your event handlers don't change names. And there's a lot of things that suddenly, if you have two files and you're sharing one as or one code behind, you know, you got to keep a clear mind. You can't just kind of do this willy-nilly.
Yep, and there are not, you know, a lot of things that you might assume that you get for free, which you probably don't when you do that. Like, you know, they are still two different files, and the elements in them are two different, you know, completely different elements. So you have to reason about state yourself. You have to reason about, the initial states and flashing and all of that. Basically, you're basically loading a different thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So this is the Microsoft Adaptive Strategy for Windows UWP apps, specifically the ones that run on Windows 10. The ability to use Visual State Manager and all of its enhancements, as well as just the ability to introduce relative panel and be able to rearrange your UI in a declarative way. In fact, more and more we look at these enhancements, everything's more and more declarative. Isn't it awesome? We're pulling out more and more code. XAML lovers love pulling more and more code out of their code behind and put it in being declarative. And of course, the benefit to us is we also get the, you know, you can see a lot more now in the designer because of that too. So there's a lot of cool things. Harini and Ben, anything you want to leave? If anything I missed, I feel like we've covered everything, but I don't want to jump past. If you're like, Jerry, when are you going to ask this?
I think we did cover everything really well. The one thing that I'll just kind of say at the end is just to exactly echo what you just said. I want everyone in sort of the XAML ecosystem to understand clearly the message from the product team. We believe in XAML. We believe in markup. We believe in being declarative. And I think you're going to see even more investments in that direction going forward.
Nice. Ooh, what an interesting little thing to say. Oh my gosh! Wow. So there's some surprises coming, perhaps. I'm just, you know, that's the way I can see the headline already. Headlines are crazy, though. All right, Harini, Ben, thanks for being on the show today.
Thanks a lot,
Jerry.
See you again.